What if I walked into a room and there was a large chest filled with gold in it? Should you yes and that?
Yeah.
It's a mimic.
Yeah, exactly. You should always yes and it. Can I pull the shotgun off the wall? Yep, it's a mimic.
Idiots. Live from the Mundangerous Pumpkin Patch in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 12 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about improvisation and making it up on the fly, both for players and GMs. But first, the Morning Glory campaign... Wait, hold on. Let me find my notes. Here it is. The party finally heads into the Mornland, and our Warhammer 40k Inquisitor will purge your heresy in the Character Creation Forge.
Before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about the Akatacon event registration, as well as some news that came out from Wizards of the Coast this month. So, first of all, if you're planning to attend Akatacon, VIP registration is done, but general registration has just begun last weekend. So, if you haven't booked slot 1 or slot 6, I am running Fiasco on Friday at 3 p.m. That's slot 1. And I will be hosting Dark Heresy Sunday at 8 a.m. in slot 6.
You do know a little bit about the setting.
I do, a little bit. Yeah. I mean, I've been reading 1D4chan most of the night to prepare for the Character Creation Forge.
We've been reading it out loud to each other.
Yeah, and laughing hysterically. But we'll get into that a little bit later. How about, let's talk about the October survey recap.
You mean like the 1.5 paragraphs we got?
Yeah, but it's like the most information we get on a monthly basis, so.
I agree with most of the results, actually. It said, fans want more setting books. Oh, imagine that. More monster books.
Oh, well, not bad.
And player options.
Haven't got many of those either.
Certainly no good ones.
No. But here's the thing. It also said that players were generally happy with the pace of slow but steady.
You know, they're half right.
They are slow. I mean, we haven't gotten a setting book, a monster book, or meaningful player options yet.
Yeah, we haven't gotten player options that are play tested.
Yeah, we've got Unearthed Arcana, and they've announced the Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide.
Which is exciting.
Yeah, but it's one book of player options, and it's still in the single setting that we've gotten any material for, which is Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, I would love one real bit of material each month, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, if they actually get to that point, great. But it hasn't been happening.
I'd be fine with one per quarter. I mean, I don't want the glut of splat books of 3.5 and 3rd edition, but I mean, I would like the game to evolve at least some in its first year, and it hasn't evolved at all.
So we've talked about sometimes you and I feel like we don't have enough pieces to work with for the Forge.
Right. Well, rest assured that they'll be fixing the Ranger maybe sometime within a year.
That's pretty quick.
Yeah, very responsive. I mean, D&D cycles only last like 6 or 7 years, so...
Maybe they're stretching this one out.
Yeah. Maybe they're just too focused on digital.
Maybe they want less money.
Maybe they just want to sell MMOs again. All right. And then we actually got some interesting new things, too, in the October Unearthed Arcana, which was Prestige classes.
Interesting is a good word for it, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't love the class, and I frankly don't love Prestige classes, but I think it's an interesting direction.
I mean, anytime they give us new mechanics for us to dig through, it's a good thing, but I don't like this mechanic. Now, I'll say, in 3.5, I loved Prestige classes. You know, they were tons of fun.
All right, well, let's talk about this Prestige class, and then we can have it out about why Prestige classes are terrible.
This one, so it's the Rune Master?
The Rune Scribe.
So, I mean, in 4E, I played a Rune Priest. I loved the flavor of it, but this feels... Like, there are role-playing prerequisites to get into the class, but then it's just... It's 6 pages long for 5 levels.
For 5 levels.
Yeah. Like, there's... If it's supposed to be fluffy, then, like, why is there so much text to read?
So, not only that, but, like, from a mechanical standpoint, you're taking 5 levels in this. They give you spell slots, but you don't gain spells. And since you have to learn spells as single classes, at level 11... you take 5 levels of wizard, you take 5 levels of this rune class, and then when you go back to wizard at level 11, you're a level 6 wizard. You've got lots of spell slots, but you can only learn up to 3rd level spells. Great. I'm level 11. I have 3rd level spells.
I guess you could mix it up with some bard and take magical secrets. It's not particularly good.
That's not how you need to implement. I mean, you could do that, but why do I have to?
And then, of course, rolled into the mechanic of the class is magic items, because the runes count as magic items.
Right.
They count against your attunement slots.
Yes.
And they're using the horrible, awful magical item rarity system to balance the power level.
But they are significantly more powerful than any other magic items of their
They're of significantly their more flexible, yes, yeah. Definitely.
Which is symptomatic of the magic item system.
Right, but it's just yet another thing where you need to read carefully and don't pick the bad choice.
Right.
Because you've got limited resources and you're going to be dragging your party down if you pick something bad or, if you are a rune scribe.
Yeah, there's also the living rune ability, which really excited you, right?
Excited, I suppose, is the word. So it lets you, on a long rest, adjust your ability scores, which changing ability scores on the fly or more frequently than when you level up isn't something that's happened since 3.5. And that's something we got rid of for good reason.
Yeah, because it's a lot of work. And I made the argument that it's only a +1 to one stat. And odds are you're going to be reducing another stat that isn't going to have a mechanical impact, right? So you'll take an odd number stat or an even number stat and drop it or whatever.
I mean, maybe you will, but maybe you're not a huge nerd like us and doing tons of math, and maybe you'll just go, oh, this is cool and this is cool. And then, yeah, you've got 2 stats to adjust. It might be your attack and your damage for multiple weapons plus skill bonuses. Like, there's, I hate rewriting my entire character sheet, erasing, rewriting it. Maybe even your hit points.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. It definitely seems to take away a lot of the elegance that we like about 5th edition.
Right.
Let's go back to our original disagreement. Why do you think prestige classes are good for D&D?
I didn't say they were good. I said that I liked them.
Okay. Is this the Power Gaming new coming out?
It was. In 3.5, I had a lot of character ideas that were really hard to realize mechanically. I mean, if you wanted to play a magic user, you could just do anything, right? Because there were so many spells.
Right.
But if you wanted to be a martial character who did really cool things but didn't actually cast spells, you needed to bend over backwards in order to get those abilities lined up. And prestige classes were one of the few ways that you could actually do it. You still weren't nearly as powerful as Cleric 20.
So, I mean, fair enough, but that was a problem of 3 and 3.5.
Oh, yeah. It was a horrible band-aid to a structural problem of the system. But I have a soft spot in my heart for them simply because they could make things a lot more fun if you were a non-magically inclined character.
See, I actually thought the original idea behind prestige classes was really cool. Like when the first splat books came out, the Scoundrel's Guide or whatever it was, right. and that sort of stuff, I thought those were all really cool concepts. And from a story and roleplay perspective, I thought they were like a great way to make your rogue a little bit different from the guy down the street's rogue.
Yeah, who doesn't love more customization?
And then it turned into exactly what you said, a way to either amp up the power of your caster or band-aid your poorly designed martial character. Either way, I mean, I don't think 5e needs that. So if we're going to do prestige classes again, which I think, again, from a roleplay perspective is really cool, they need to be better integrated into individual classes so that they just replace levels of a class flat out and they're balanced for the levels they're replacing. So if you take a prestige class at 10, you're locked into that prestige class from then on is how I would prefer to do it.
I think that is potentially doable. I certainly don't like the multi-classing mechanic that they're currently trying to implement.
Yeah, and that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, already we've seen that multi-classing too much really just results in a character that has a lot of low-level abilities and can't actually participate at high levels.
Or they're going to try and make very scaling abilities for these prestige classes, and then things are going to get completely out of hand because they're going to be way too powerful.
Right, or just way too complicated.
Either one would not be good.
Mm-hmm. So maybe try again, Wizards.
Yeah. Don't improvise. Plan it out.
Very carefully.
All right. So how should we segue into the Morning Glory recap?
What does it say in the notes?
We don't have any notes on that. Just do it live.
Yeah. Okay. The Morning Glory campaign finally makes its way to the Mornland, which the entire campaign has been building toward. Now, if you haven't played Eberron, the Mornland is what was left, the horrible blasted wasteland that was left after the entire country of Seer was destroyed in a magical catastrophe on the Day of Mourning. One of the characters, Kallik, the paladin of vengeance, was from Seer. He lost his family, his wife, who was pregnant at the time with their child. And of course, his main motivation that we talked about in the character goals episode was figuring out what happened. At this point, he blames House Caneth, the dragon-marked house that is comprised mostly of artificers and tends to tinker with magic in ways that maybe it shouldn't be tinkered with. So in sort of introducing the Mornland to the party, I wanted to make sure that they really understood the horror and the mystery of the place. So Shane, had this been the first time that you as a player had ever actually been to the Mornland?
Yeah.
Right, yeah, because this is the first time you'd played in Eberron, yeah?
Right, because I thought we were playing Ravenloft.
The Moorland's a little Ravenlofty, right?
It's dark.
Right.
It's full of wandering damage.
It's so much wandering damage. So mechanically, in the source books, an entire country is enveloped with this sort of cocoon of what's called the Dead Gray Mist. When a character enters it, they become very disoriented and they can become completely lost or end up somewhere that they didn't expect to be. So this is sort of what I had to work with, but the characters and the players knew that they were moving toward this obstacle. So I sort of dragged out the approach a long time on the lightning rail in the wasteland outside of the Dead Gray Mists, the slow approach, and then finally them deciding, okay, we'll enter and we'll just kind of see what happens. And luckily for me, they rolled pretty poorly on a survival check.
Party got lost.
Yes. Yes, you did. Inside the Dead Gray Mist, which was great. Because at this point, we talked about in the Deadly Environments episode, the one thing that you really need to do is be consistent when you have your party in a place where they're suffering, right? So once they understand the rules of the place, oh, okay, if you touch the water, it burns you or whatever, right? Then you stay consistent with that, and then they're rewarded for knowing what's going on here. They become more accustomed to the environment. But the Mornland is a place that doesn't make any sense. The laws of physics and of magic have broken down. It's supposed to be a place that is unpredictable and keeps you on your toes. So I wanted to make sure that they understood that anything could happen and that it was probably going to be weird and at least a little bit horrific, which is a great opportunity for improvisation, depending on how you feel like your party is reacting to the stimuli that you're presenting them with. So in this instance, I had a series of events planned, things that could happen as you were wandering in and lost in the mist. But I didn't necessarily know when they would happen, and I didn't determine randomly when they would happen.
So what were some of the examples that you tortured us with?
There was the acid rain. That was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I have a thing with rain. There was acid rain, and then there was a rain of arrows, literal arrows, that fell out of the sky that you dodged.
You mostly also, I think, rained blood.
There was, so that was interesting, right? So there was the acid rain, and then the arrow rain, and then you heard thunder in the distance and went, oh no, we really need to hide. This is going to be bad. And then it was just normal, regular blood. It was gross, but it didn't hurt.
Yeah, that was a friendly consideration on your part.
The point was, again, to be unpredictable, right? And then after that, there was the bone rain, right? Like knuckle bones.
Mm-hmm.
Those bled a bit as well.
There was also like the psychic thunderstorm.
Oh, yes. That was my favorite part, right? Things that don't make sense mechanically to you guys.
Yeah, it was great because I couldn't avoid my perception. Yeah,
right. So
I kept passing my perception checks.
Right.
I kept trying to fail so I wouldn't hear it.
Right. So it was this eerie wail, and only the characters that actually passed their perception checks heard it and then took psychic damage. And then the DC was lowered, and those characters then needed to make another perception check, and on until they failed.
Yeah.
It didn't just telegraph that the characters are experiencing something, you know, strange and odd, but mechanically it was disorienting for the players, because wait, rolling high is bad? Wait, I'm trying to roll as low as possible? This doesn't make any sense.
I briefly considered stabbing my ears out.
Oh, that would have been great.
Yeah. I mean, it's one restoration away. Or regeneration.
Regeneration. Level 7.
We were almost there.
Ish. Yeah. And then I think once you finally broke through the dead gray mist, then there was the Forest of Bleeding Trees.
Charming.
Yeah. For anyone who hasn't played in Eberron, or who is playing in Eberron but hasn't yet gone to the Mornland, I highly, highly recommend it. One of my favorite things to do when preparing for this was just doing searches for all of the threads on, you know, 1001 awful things that should happen in the Mornland. I had lists and lists of like random creepy things that you would come across. And of course, I only used about half of them because you can't cram everything in, you know?
Yeah, we would have been dead. If you had wanted to kill us, we would have been dead on the journey.
Certainly. So. Or some were just weird and creepy.
Right.
And, you know, we'll get into some of those in future episodes because you spent quite a while in the Mornland.
Yeah, I mean, the point of this, right, was to make it strange and painful to be there. And I have to say, it was kind of a roller coaster, because after we got through each terrible encounter, it was like, okay, finally, it's just that crappy, dead, gray mist. Let's pass the survival check and make some progress. And then it was like, oh no. Oh no, it's happening again. Oh God, what is it going to be this time? Oh, it's only blood. Whew. Oh, right. Crap, it's blood and bones. Yeah, I mean, it was a little limited in what we could do from a role-playing perspective, but from like a playing a game perspective, it very much had that feeling of Paranormal Activity, actually, where the daytime scenes were like very calm and peaceful and you really liked the characters, and then when night fell, you were like, oh my God, please just get through this night.
Yeah, I think part of the thing about evoking that air of horror and foreboding isn't just slamming your party with tons of damage, right? It's maybe with the potential for tons of damage.
The potential is way worse.
Right. Because, you know, if you do actually do it consistently, well, then they're just
going to die. I mean,
right,
you're going to win if you want to. It's not that hard to win when you're the GM.
Or, you know, they're not presented with a meaningful decision. Their decision ends up being, oh, we have to rest. Like, we have to rest or we're going to die. So I guess we'll rest here.
Well, resting in the Mornland wasn't easy either.
Right. In 3.5, there are lots of things preventing you from, you know, magical healing doesn't work. And I had to translate that into 5e mechanics.
Right. So it basically became hide inside your bag of holding.
Right.
Or inside a scroll of rope trick.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
And then we were like, well, we only have 10 of those scrolls. Is this a time to heal? Can we afford to? And then we probably ended up with like 6 left over, which just made me feel dumb. I sold you Kyber shards for what?
I mean, it's a good thing that you guys did your research to begin with, or you would have gone in with no scrolls or rope trick.
That would have been bad. Yes. We would have promptly come back out.
Through the dead gray mist.
Probably gotten lost on the way. Yeah, not good.
So let's talk about improvising.
Oh, well, that's not in the notes.
Let's just go for it.
Okay, fine.
So every tabletop RPG involves some level of improvisation, right? Because if it didn't, it would be the same thing as wargaming or playing video games.
Yeah, that's actually a really important piece of it that a lot of new players, I think, miss, especially if you're running off of published adventures, is maybe it's not abundantly clear that there's just situations that come up that you just got to wing it.
Yeah, like there's no way for every possible option or combination or thing that your party might come up with on the fly to fit into a normal published adventure. I mean, unless you want to be working out of, you know, multiple volumes of an encyclopedia.
I mean, not only a published adventure, but if you're planning your adventure on your own, there's no way. Like, if you plan 15 things, they're going to choose the 16th.
Yeah.
So,
what was the point?
Right. Yeah. The key to that, too, is also to plan to improvise.
Absolutely. Yeah. Know that you're going to do it. So if you're a GM who doesn't like to do it or doesn't feel comfortable with it, you just need to dive in because, you know, be terrible at it for a little while. I was definitely terrible at it and sometimes still am.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, that's the only way to get better at it.
So what are some ways to improvise?
Well, I mean, you can do it player-led, which is responding in the moment to player suggestions or player questions and giving them answers or information that you didn't necessarily prepare ahead of time. So, you know, it's the sort of that traditional improv, yes and.
So I feel like a lot of GMs get into trouble with this because we always say, as a community, right, say yes and, help your players out, right? Have an improvisational attitude, and then GMs yes and themselves into a corner.
Yes, and you should also sometimes say no.
Right. So how do you know when to say no? Because it seems to me that the trick is not being able to say yes and. Anyone can go along with it. The key is knowing how and when to say no, right?
Or maybe knowing how to say no in a way that doesn't feel like a no. Sometimes instead of no, it's yes, but. Or no, however.
Uh-huh.
I think the point is to make sure that the player doesn't feel like they've necessarily been shut down. Because lots of times, you know, a player asks, can I do this thing, right? Like, can I throw this rock to distract the guard or mm-hmm. whatever?
Sure.
Right? And sometimes the answer is totally no. But it the player isn't necessarily asking the question because, like, that's the thing they want to do. They just want to do something. They're attempting to overcome this obstacle. So offer them another way to overcome this obstacle.
Okay, fair enough. But what if the player wants to pull a shotgun off the wall and shoot the guard?
Did you say that there was a shotgun on the wall?
No, but yes and.
Yes, and you can't do that because there's no shotgun on the wall.
Yeah, I mean, that's the key is it's
yes,
okay.
And that's stupid.
It's a shared imagination, right? So right. You're never going to account for every possible detail. And the way that you describe it might invoke something in your player's imagination that sounds great. So shotgun is a bad example, but let's say that there's guards at the entrance to a cave. Perhaps there's a river flowing out of that cave. You didn't plan on there being a river or a stream flowing out of that cave, but could you use the sound of that river to mask your footsteps? I don't see why not.
Right. And, you know, improvise these things in ways that are believable. Like if someone asks, is there a river nearby? It doesn't need to be coming out of the mouth of the cave because, you know, maybe that would have been super obvious. But is there one next to the cave, behind the cave? Yeah, certainly.
Sure. Or, I mean, is there some brush and shrubs and, you know, low trees that might obscure my approach?
Right, exactly. The player isn't really asking, is there a river coming out of the mouth of the cave? They're asking, do I have some piece of terrain that I can use to make my approach quieter? So give them a different one. If, like, you know, absolutely, I wrote this all down and, you know, there's no river here.
This works better if you didn't provide a map. But my point is that yes and is a tool, but it's not the only tool. There comes a point when we need to stop adding things to the scene and we just need to play the scene out.
It's certainly a mantra for people who have trouble making things up. It can also get you into trouble if you don't have problems making things up.
Right. Yeah. So there's more than just yes and. What are some of the other types of improvisation that occur in role-playing games?
Well, there's also GM-led improvisation is what I might call it. It's the thing that I think most GMs are already doing without necessarily calling it improvisation, right? You do a bit of minor prep to facilitate your improvisation, and then, you know, you wing a lot of things. Like, I like to come up with lists of names because those are so hard to make up on the fly.
Oh my God, whenever I get asked for a name of an NPC, I'm just like, you're a dick. Like, you know I don't have a name handy.
Right.
And then I'm either going to interrupt the flow of the story by asking you guys to pick a name, which is almost certainly going to be a dick joke. Or I've got to be like, wait, I have it here. And I'm like flipping through pages and pretending mm-hmm. that I have a name written down. And I'm just hoping to come up with something. And I usually pick a soccer player. Because no one in our group follows soccer. So it seems legit.
I think that works really well. Sometimes the thing I do is I take a normal name and change one letter.
Oh, yeah. Change the I to a Y.
No, wait, that doesn't help. That doesn't help at all when you're not writing it down. But Davin, you know?
Oh, sure.
Oh, that's a fantasy name.
Oh, yeah. That sounds very fantasy-ish.
Mavid. But yeah, so you prep rough outlines, rough sketches in your head, and then from there you can fill in the details or, you know, have your players help you fill in the details.
Yeah, I like to start with a list of names, literally just a list of, say, 15 names. And usually I have names for, like, locations and then names for people. And whenever we come across something over the course of the session where I need a proper noun, I just pick the name that fits best, mm-hmm. and I write next to it what I used it for. And then from now on, that person is named Merrick's DeKenneth.
Later in the Morning Glory campaign, you guys met many dragons and many angels, and they all have the craziest names.
Right, right.
And so I just spent like an hour putting together as many dragon and angel names as I could and put them on a list, and I just kept that for months and just crossed them off as like you came across these people.
Right, right. And then the same thing, like the names of taverns.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you go to Don
or
John...
Or just pick one tavern, and every tavern is that tavern.
Right. The Dewdrop Inn.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah. The other handy resource is Don John, which actually is just a handy resource for GMs in general, at donjon.bin.sh.
That's donjon.
Yeah. You could just Google donjon. But that just has a bunch of random generators. And
also sometimes takes you to the Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie.
Yeah. That movie just screwed up role-playing forever.
Actually, whenever I GM, I like to leave the Donjon site just open on my phone. Because, it's so useful.
Right. And you can get a list of 10 fantasy names just at the click of a button. So saves you a ton of time.
Right.
And,
if you didn't prep ahead of time for an hour.
Yeah. What ends up happening is I can't pick the names that I like, and I'm like, oh, I don't want to use any of those are too good for this guy. I need a new random one to throw away.
Pick a regular name,
right?
Change one letter.
All right, his name is Shave. Yeah, he's Shave, a barber, why do you ask?
Shave Maircut. So once you're making up all of these things, one thing I find helpful to keep in mind is you've got this central point. Right. You've made these rough sketches, or you have this story or whatever, and you're making things up and branching off from there. Be careful not to follow one branch continually, or else you just end up nowhere near where you were before. You've lost the thread of the story, right? So think of it like you don't want it to be like a Simpsons episode where the beginning has absolutely nothing to do with the end.
Okay, I'm following. I mean, I'm not sure if I agree yet, but continue.
Circle back around. So you're making up.
So make it like a sitcom.
Yes.
Where the story never advances.
It advances.
An early 90s sitcom.
In the next session advances. No, no. You can serialize it. It's fine. Just don't make it the first 10 minutes of Family Guy.
So one trick that I use for that is I plot relationship maps as they develop. So every one of the players meet that I want to have some significance.
Like a family tree? Do you do family trees?
Not a family tree, but more just like, okay, so this guy is over here on the right and this gal is over on the top, and if they have some connection to each other, I just note that with a dotted line. Mm-hmm. And
hates them.
Right, exactly.
And this one hates the party.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you start to plot their allies and enemies, and then you can kind of see natural places where you might have their allies and enemies interact, and it makes a richer world around you. Mm-hmm. The best part is it's just visual. So you look at the map and you say, okay, well, this is a great time to add complication here. Done.
Right. And I think this is a very important point when it comes to all this improvisation that you're doing. Write it down as you go, or at the very least, at the end of the session, like write down all the things that got made up, because you want it to be consistent.
That's how you do world building.
Right.
Without typing up a 1,000-page campaign setting that no one's going to read.
Yeah. And then, of course, you don't have to make it up again next time.
Right.
Right. Now these people exist. Great.
It's amazing how much players notice when you rename a character, even if they don't know the name of that character. If you forget the name of a character, they kind of move on. But if you change the name, somebody's going to remember what it was originally, and you've just completely taken them out of the story for no reason.
Yeah. So what about for people who, like the advice and they want to try more of this, but they just can't get into it. They feel like they're not comfortable with it. Any advice for those people?
Yeah. But it's just not good advice. I mean, unfortunately, you have to practice. No one's good at something the first time they do it. And so...
How about heavy drinking?
Okay. But the problem with drinking heavily before trying to improv a session is that while the session might be fun in the moment, you're not going to have the notes to have any continuity with that, right?
It's very true.
I actually don't know how you did it throughout the Morning Glory campaign.
So this is something that I'll say. Part of the reason that I feel like I was able to improvise well during Morning Glory is that I'm a big fan of the Eberron setting. And so sort of like, you know, you and I talk about 40K, I spent a lot of time just immersing myself in the lore of the setting. And so I almost studied it like mythology. So I knew it really, really well. And it wasn't, oh, you know, what is this thing that they're going to... No, I know what is the dominant religious power in this part of this area of Droam or whatever, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. That's one of the benefits of using a really detailed published setting, is that if you spend enough time ahead of time getting to know it and you enjoy that sort of thing, it makes it much easier to build off the more structured setting that you've already got.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, not everyone's going to have that luxury, though. I certainly will never be able to do that, because outside of maybe Warhammer 40K, just because I've been doing that since I was like 8.
You just started a 13 book Abnett Opus.
Yes, I started Gaunt's Ghosts. Yeah.
So anyone who can sign up for Shane's Dark Heresy game at Akatacon, I highly recommend it, because he knows his stuff.
And I know where I can make it up. It's more like I know what I don't know.
Right. So yes, I'm certainly not saying that like that kind of in-depth knowledge of a setting is necessary or even necessarily desirable. It's a good fallback if you don't feel like you're good at improvising, but you are, you know, very wedded to a particular setting. And that, I think those two things often go hand in hand.
Yeah, there's also a really good book on improvisational DMing called Never Unprepared. It should be available on Amazon. It's also available from enginepublishing.com, and it's by Phil Vecchione, I think. But it basically covers the way to prepare for a session so that you're ready to improvise. And that's really the trick to me, is learn what is the stuff that you need to know going in to be comfortable with making up the rest as you go. And unfortunately, you just have to practice. I mean, you'll never get better if you don't try.
Yeah. Another actually good way to practice is play games that require improvisation.
Like Fiasco.
I was just going to say, Fiasco is so good for this.
I know, which is so fitting that I'm running that in the very first session slot of Akatacon.
So everyone should do that as well.
Yeah.
And then call Shane on all the stuff he makes up in the Dark Heresy game.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah, just call him out.
Just join my game. I don't want to be alone.
So quickly, just a few times that are good in games to improvise, if you just want to sprinkle more of it in, exploration. It's why come up with every single detail of a place that your party is going to look at for 10 minutes? You know, make it up on the fly.
Yeah, or this works in some games, not in every game and not for every feel or theme of every game, but you can also ask your players to tell you what they see.
Mm.
If they're imagining the dungeon themselves and they open up into a room that otherwise doesn't have anything important, ask them, what do you see in this room? Is there a brazier in here? Is there a caved in wall? You know, let them describe it. Or if you have a crowd of people, ask them to pick out a couple people that they notice from the crowd and tell you something about them. Let them help you improvise.
It's also a nice way to get players invested in the environment, mm-hmm. if they sort of came up with it on their own.
Yeah. If you said there's a brazier in a room, when you fight orcs in this room in a few minutes, you're probably going to try and use that brazier to your advantage, right?
Yeah, because I said it was heavy, right? It's heavy brazier.
Right,
That's what I said.
What about puzzles?
Puzzles, absolutely improvise the solutions to your puzzles. Don't come up with the actual answers. Don't do it.
Okay, that seems really risky. You got to explain that one to me.
Okay, so it's like the Tomb of Horrors scenario. There's a random sequence of events that needs to occur in order for like this particular trap to be disengaged or for this wall to open up and in order for the story to actually continue. So don't punish your players for not being able to come up with this random list of criteria.
That's not a puzzle. that's just a crappy
Sometimes, you know, sometimes the puzzle, I mean, usually they're bad puzzles, right? But sometimes it's, you know, place the four idols in the particular spots on the chessboard or whatever, right? So just don't have the four particular spots figured out ahead of time. If your players come up with something that is reasonable, that could reasonably be a solution to a puzzle, even if it's not exactly the one that you came up with, you know, ahead of time, make that the answer.
I still don't know that I necessarily agree with you. I don't like using puzzles, period. So,
yes.
I generally try to avoid puzzles, but if I were going to use a puzzle, I would have an answer, and I'm with you. If the party puts forth a good answer that I didn't consider, fine. You did it. You figured it out. But I can't imagine constructing a puzzle and not having an answer and just hoping the party comes up with something good enough for me to say, good work. Because if they don't, and God forbid they ever find out, it's going to be a disaster.
We'll never tell them, right? Let them come up with it on their own.
They might figure out that you don't seem to know what's going on here.
I never had any answers to any puzzles
I know.
In Morning Glory.
Oh, I know.
Only because I told you later.
Yeah, well, don't podcast with your players either.
Right.
You'll have to talk about all your secrets. Yeah, I don't know. I get what you're saying. That's too risky for me.
Well, then, in that case, what about combat? Do you make stuff up during combat?
Oh, I make stuff up in combat all the time. So we've talked about before that when I prep combats, I generally go through and I'll pick, for whatever level of difficulty that I want, I'll go through and pick the enemies out of the monster manual. And then whenever it comes time to do combat, I put it on a post-it note. I pull out that post-it note and that's the encounter. And it doesn't matter if that is an encounter with orcs or that is an encounter with demons. I'm just going to reskin them to be whatever I need them to be. Generally, I don't pick something as specific as demons, you know, but like humanoids, they're all basically the same. So why couldn't my orcs also just be guards?
So in the middle of combat, do you adjust things on the fly? Do you improvise numbers or reinforcements or timing or hit points?
Timing I do. Hit points I don't. I don't fudge anything in combat.
Except for timing and reinforcements.
Yeah, so I don't have reinforcements come on, you know, they're going to come in round three. Mm-hmm. Because if the party is wiped, if the enemy is wiped by round three, they're never going to come, right?
Mm.
Doesn't make sense. So basically, if I have reinforcements coming, they're coming at a logical point in the drama, not a logical point in the encounter. But I don't really do reinforcements either. I generally try to make combat over as quickly as possible because it's not what I really enjoy. And I'm not very good at being super tactical because, like, again, I get bored.
That makes sense.
I mean, unless it's my character at risk, then I take it personally. See, my thing is you're supposed to win combat until you're not, right? And if we're going to let the dice fly, let the dice fly.
I think the important thing here is don't let your players see behind the curtain. Maybe you're running a combat where you are playing it where it lies with the dice, and maybe you're changing some things for plot purposes. Don't let them know. And as long as they don't know, it all feels the same.
Yeah, if your players ever find out that you fudge,
you're ruined.
It's over.
Yeah.
Because nothing is fun anymore if they're always questioning whether or not you let them.
Right.
So
my players, I fudge until I don't.
Yeah, you always fudge. We know.
No, I don't always.
You produce a good story, and that's what we care about.
There you go.
The thing, for me, the big thing is that I can't kill a player by fiat. So it doesn't seem fair to me if I'm going to truly risk killing them if I ever fudge.
Well, never kill your players.
Okay, characters. But he's just such a problem player. Doesn't honor our social contract.
Such a lone wolf.
He has to die.
Sorry, officer. He's chaotic evil.
And he wasn't playing his character to his alignment.
All right. And improvise when you didn't have any prep time. That's usually the main reason people get into it in the first place.
Either because they didn't have prep time or because they wanted to cut down their prep time.
Maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah, a little bit of both.
Or, you know, let's say you have like a podcast, but you also have a new job and, you know, you need to like write up some show notes. But you just didn't get to it.
Hang on, that's a little too inside baseball.
Maybe you could just wing most of an episode.
Do you hear that, Ishan?
Yes, and why don't you tell us what it means?
That sound can only mean one thing, that it's time to move on to the Character Creation Forge. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from our listeners.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show, at TPTcast. Or you can email us, if you can't fit it into 140 characters, at totalpartythrill@gmail.com. And finally, you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com. So this week in the Forge, we are drawing from my aforementioned favorite setting, Warhammer 40K. We are doing an Imperial Inquisitor.
Yeah, you basically played an Imperial Inquisitor in the Morning Glory campaign.
Yeah, but I played a dirty Radical Inquisitor. I didn't stick to any of the rules of the Inquisition, and I had my reasons.
Yeah, in Eberron, there are Inquisitors of the Silver Flame, but heresy is just much easier to get away with in a world where magic's pretty common.
Yeah, and that's kind of a big part of the 40K Inquisition, is that a big part of their job is to chase down rogue psykers, which are the magic equivalents of 40K.
Right, like if low-level artificers were always in danger of having their brains explode into greater demons, I think the Inquisition would be a lot stronger in Eberron.
Hey, the Eberron Inquisition did snuff out werewolves.
And most of the shifter population.
Yeah, so, I mean, they did some threat elimination.
/ genocide.
Right, yeah, whatever. They're the grim darkiest of a not very grim dark setting.
It's true, it's true.
So actually, Eberron is kind of grim, if you think about it.
It can get grim. You guys didn't go into many of the extraordinarily grim places.
The Moorland.
Okay, I suppose that, but...
I mean...
I want to do a whole campaign in Droam. It's run by monsters.
That is, like, wrist-slittingly bad. So let's talk about the key points of our build and what we ended up with.
Human.
Had to be human.
Of course.
Because this is the Imperium. The Imperium is only human.
Yes. But the build itself, it's actually fairly similar to your brand build with some minor tweaks that we threw in. It's Rogue One.
Because Rogue One is the best.
Nearly every build we put together is Rogue One.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Ranger One. This is rare for us.
Continuing the theme of trying to use Ranger desperately.
Right? Just cram it in there somehow.
Yep.
But, of course, only one level.
And right, because you can't do two levels.
Right, really. What's the point?
That's silly.
And that, you know, that's really just for tracking and favorite enemy heretics.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
That's good. I mean, or demons and humanoids.
Yeah, like, yeah. You can do fiends. Or two kinds of humanoids.
You have to decide which order you're from, right? Are you chasing heretics and thus humanoids? Mm. Are you chasing Xenos, in which case you probably take like, orcs and something else?
Right.
Or are you chasing Ordo Malleus? Are you fighting fiends?
Totally up to you. Although, I mean, I guess you could take Ranger all the way to, I think it's 6, and you pick another favorite enemy.
Don't do that.
Don't. That's the point. Why? Because you need room for Paladin.
You won't be powerful enough if you take 6 levels of Ranger, and thus you will be a failed Inquisitor.
Yeah, you really will be.
6 levels of Paladin.
That's a great idea.
Inquisition stuff.
We could have gone, you know, a defensive paladin of devotion, and gone 7 levels and gotten immunity to charm, but that's not a 40K Inquisitor.
40K Inquisitor is always on the edge of being a heretic himself.
That's right.
He has to walk the line.
Yeah. Oath of Vengeance.
Right.
Oath of Vengeance it is. Yep. So 6 levels is all you really need. You know, that sort of gets you everything.
Yeah, you have your smite, you have a second attack, and then you have your level 6 ability, the bonus to all your saves.
Aura of Protection. Charisma bonus to saving throws.
Right. And then from there, we decided Bard the rest of the way.
Right. There are a few options. Obviously, on the high ends of these builds, we try to build in some wiggle room. But yeah, Bard is great if your Ordo is okay with you maybe being a sanctioned psyker.
Yeah, so Bard is the sanctioned psyker magic because it's divine. Oh, well, no, it's not. It's arcane.
It's arcane, yeah.
Ah, shit. We built a filthy radical.
But it's sanctioned. Right? If anything is sanctioned, it would be Bard.
I don't follow.
I just want it to be. So what would be sanctioned? It certainly wouldn't be Sorcerer. Certainly wouldn't be Warlock.
Okay, you're right, yeah. But, no, fair enough.
And it wouldn't be Wizard because... there really aren't wizards because no one is like delving into knowledge to learn this stuff.
Well, except for Space Marine librarians.
Oh, yeah. So I guess they would be wizards, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. So you could be an unsanctioned psyker if you're a wild mage sorcerer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You could be a horrifically unsanctioned psyker if you're a warlock, which is like Eisenhornian.
Right. Or a dragon source. Right. Because you have tainted bloodline.
That's a good one. So, yeah. So that leaves Bard. All right. Settled. We're going Bard.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, so Bard works really well. You get access to Shield, which is Telekine Shield, Telekine Dome.
Yep. The key to that is that you can boost your AC quite high.
Obscene levels, like, yeah.
And that really is the trick of the Inquisitor. It's not that you're necessarily the best in combat or the most versatile in terms of your casting. It's that you should be extremely hard to kill. You should be the Emperor's never say die. So that means you've already boosted your saves by being a paladin, and then now you'll use magic as much as possible to boost your AC.
Right, you're immune to disease.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is handy when you're fighting those Nurgle plague cults.
Right. So yeah, you can go bard pretty much to the end. You could go paladin to 10, which gets you aura of courage and immunity to being frightened, also very helpful. Although you actually lose out on some smite potential because you get fewer spells.
Yeah, and frankly, fear is not that big of an effect.
I mean, if you pick your spells correctly, yeah.
Well, I mean, just there's not that many things that target PCs with fear.
Unless you're fighting demons.
Or dragons.
Yeah, dragons.
So those DCs aren't that high either.
With your aura protection, yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You've got an excellent chance of passing those. The other option is cleric. You need to get quite a few ability scores to 13 to multiclass this much, but an inquisitor does anything that is necessary in order to get the resources that they need.
Yep.
And one level of knowledge cleric gets you two more expertises in knowledge skills, which... you can never have too many knowledge skills if you're an inquisitor.
Yeah, I mean, really, you should have all of the knowledge and then probably intimidation.
Yeah.
If you've got six expertises between cleric, right, rogue, and bard.
Five knowledges and one more.
And if you were going to skip a knowledge, maybe nature.
Yeah, I mean, you can always pay someone to do that.
Right.
Yeah. That, and, you know, that's not going to help you in a hive.
No, that's the thing. It's very urban.
Or in the void.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. Yeah, nature.
All those other planes that you're gonna have to go to.
Just exterminatus it and done. Oh, your ranger favored terrain should be dead world. death world, sorry.
Death world, yeah. death world is a world where everything wants to kill you. All right, so shall we tell the story of our divergent inquisitors?
Please do.
So I think we're gonna start off pretty similar here with Rogue One. That will be our young inquisitor as a youth in the dregs of a hive world somewhere, where he will be taken under the wing of a thoughtful and far-seeing inquisitor. From then, he'll take six levels of paladin, and that is him gaining knowledge of the Emperor and his service and learning to harness all of his abilities, slowly manifesting his latent psychic abilities. Then, after so long on the trail of heretics, he'll take that level of ranger as he's truly mastered the art of tracking them down.
And after he has his extra attack.
Right, yeah, most importantly. And then my inquisitor will be the bard. He will focus on boosting his already quite capable combat prowess using more and more psychic ability, channeling that into his blade as much as possible, and also gaining some handy abilities like the aforementioned shield and whatnot. And this is how he will chase down demons as a member of the Ordo Xenos.
Malleus.
This is how he will chase down demons as a member of the Ordo Malleus. Just improv it. It's fine.
But yeah, it was great. Roll with it. Yes, and it's the Ordo Malleus.
Right.
So you're right. Our backstories do start off similarly in that my inquisitor also began as a wayward youth.
It's almost as if there's an inquisitorial career path.
I mean, okay, in the Imperium, if you're not a wayward youth, you just live out your boring life in the Administratum.
Right, that's true.
Yeah. However, mine is a man of faith, or at least becomes a man of faith.
Okay.
It's that turning point, that thing that gets you off the street.
Uh-huh.
You know, watching your best friend killed in the process of, you know, mugging some people.
Okay.
And then, yeah, rededicates his life to the Emperor, the God Emperor of Mankind.
As you do.
Yeah, and takes those paladin levels. But is not yet a member of the Inquisition. Actually, his paladin abilities come from acts of faith.
Oh, right? Okay. Right. So he's a member of the Ecclesiarchy.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Which, nobody likes them.
No.
Right, so he's really kind of a bad paladin, like a mean paladin.
Well, the Ecclesiarchy has their own militant wing.
They do indeed. But of course, no one is safe from the depredations of the Inquisition. And if you get caught up in the wrong kind of mission, well, I guess you're not in the Ecclesiarchy anymore.
Wah, wah.
And this is where the level of Ranger comes in, when he is filled with the burning desire to hunt down the filthy Xenos.
Ah, mm-hmm. An Ordo Xenos.
I really do actually wish that there was some way to emulate Favorite Enemy Heretic, but I think we're going to go Elf, and he'll hunt down the Eldar. Maybe Drow, the Dark Eldar.
Oh, I like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you get two humanoids, you might as well have him ready to fight orcs as well.
Ooh, yeah, I like it. And then from there, instead of taking Bard, I take Cleric, because that gets you War Cleric. So your Inquisitor is very defensively minded, right?
Oh, definitely.
Right. And
because to die for the Emperor prematurely is the gravest of sins.
Mine is more offensively oriented, using War Cleric ability to cast and smash and then pop a smite.
Nice.
Yeah. And also takes the lucky feat so that he relies on the grace of the God Emperor to survive.
Oh, the lucky feat is pretty much mandatory
for an Inquisitor.
Yeah. I mean, you're going to have to reroll quite a bit.
Yes.
I mean, the life of an Inquisitor is literally taking on things that are 10 times your level. Like, not just 10 levels higher than you, 10 times your level.
Yeah, it's too bad CR doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I know.
What's the CR of this? It's 150.
Right. Oh, we're killing Vecna now? Asmodeus was only a 20.
I think Vecna's a Necron. Or maybe a Catan.
Oh. Yeah.
Shard. At least a Shard, maybe.
Yeah, that could be.
He's the Void Dragon.
So now I just want to play this game in 5e.
I told you I want to run Dungeons and Dark Heresy. But you guys didn't seem that into it.
I know. All right. Have we kicked this one enough?
I think so. I think it's time we beg for reviews.
Indeed it is. You can find us on iTunes. And if you're willing to give us a 5-star review, we will read it on the air. You can also find us on Stitcher, which is like a Pandora for podcasts. If you give us a plus or add us to your favorite list, that will help other people find us in the Stitcher algorithm and help bring you more great content like ours. And I think we have a 5-star review this week.
We do indeed. It's by Justin Rivendell. Great program. 5 stars. As someone who has always wanted to play but has never had a play group, this podcast gives me a really good sense of some of the finer minutiae of character building and play dynamics. Hopefully someday I get to put some of this into practice. You know, Justin, we do too.
Yeah, that sucks. Let's find... Justin, tweet us. We'll find you a game online.
Yeah, we got this.
Yeah, we'll totally hook you up. All right, so what do we have planned for next week's episode?
Well, we'll be talking about alignment.
And in the character creation forge?
The smuggler.
Oh, I see where this is going.
No, you don't, actually, because it's gone. And you really don't want to know where it went.
In that case, I guess that's it for episode 12 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.